This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In. Coming up, Indiana's next-level jobs program does things a little differently compared to many other states. What sets this one apart? And the opioid epidemic is still around. It's just not making headlines. Why the colder months and COVID-19 could make it worse. And finally, Pete the Planner stops by to throw some cold water on our finances. If it's been a tight year because of the pandemic, he wants us to resist the urge to splurge this holiday season. But first, we'll look at Indiana's biggest headlines from this past week with our digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. Let's look at the numbers, though, which are not great.
Yeah, they're decidedly bad. I think that we can say that with some confidence. As of noon today, 4,952 people have died from COVID-19, not including the probable deaths. Today, we reported 6,912 new COVID-19 cases.
Wow.
That's
wow.
The third highest reported, behind Saturday's 8,451. Over the last week, 339 confirmed deaths were reported by ISDH, which is way beyond our peak for deaths in late April. And that's paired with nearly 46,000 new positive COVID-19 cases in the last 7 days. It was just 2 short weeks ago, actually, that we surpassed 2,000 hospitalizations due to COVID-19, and we've had more than 3,000 for the last 3 days. Indiana's 7-day average has increased by a super great number, 666.6%.
Oh, boy.
Since the state moved to stage 5, which means we're at more than 7.5 times the 7-day average from September 26th to now. In that same time period, 86 out of 92 counties have more than doubled their number of reported cases. Fountain, Adams, and Warren counties have 5 times their total cases since September 26th. And it was only 3 weeks ago that we hit 4,000 confirmed deaths. We'll likely hit 5,000 deaths either tomorrow or Saturday for confirmed cases. Probable deaths put us over a couple of days ago. And then taking a quick look at our color-coded map, when it was updated on Wednesday, only 21 counties are only, goodness gracious, that's the wrong qualifier. 21 counties were designated as red, the highest risk category for as designated by ISDH. Only one county remained yellow, and the other 70 are orange, indicating widespread community spread.
Hmm. Do we know what the yellow county is off the top of our heads?
It is Putnam County.
Putnam County. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good for them. This week at the State House was Organization Day, right?
It was. So Organization Day, Org Day, is kind of like spring training for baseball, right? So there's like a ton of work that goes on behind the scenes leading up to this point. And Org Day tends to showcase some of the possibilities for the next legislative session and can also highlight some of the problems that might be coming up. Senate Democrats made a last-ditch call for redistricting reform, which the minority caucus has been pushing for unsuccessfully for more than a decade. And House Republicans rejected an effort to require lawmakers to wear a mask while on the floor, in the hall, or in community and conducting official House business. Only 2 of the more than 90 House lawmakers in attendance Tuesday refused to wear a mask. Milford Representative Republican Kurt Nicely and Indianapolis Representative John Jacob, both Republicans. Mm. And then Democrats in both chambers say the legislature isn't prepared to safely conduct its legislative session in the middle of a COVID-19 pandemic. Republican legislative leaders say they haven't decided on any COVID-19 testing or screening procedures for lawmakers during session. They also haven't determined a threshold for when the session might need to shut down temporarily because of positive cases. Leaders said Tuesday members won't be allowed to participate in community hearings virtually, in committee hearings virtually, nor will they be allowed to vote remotely. And Democratic Representative Robin Shackelford and Governor Eric Holcomb both told reporters Tuesday they had been in close contact with people who had tested positive for the virus.
Okay. But we don't know yet if they have tested negative. They've been kind of staying away, haven't they?
Yeah. So I know 100% that Governor Holcomb has been in quarantine. I don't know 100% that Representative Shackelford has. I believe she probably has. But yeah, the fact that at least two people on Org Day had been interacting with crowds while masked up, but had still been in contact with people who had the virus is a bit of a warning sign for things to maybe come during the legislative session.
Was anyone there at the State House seeing how things looked? I mean, did things look somewhat normal? Because Organization Day can kind of be a shoulder to shoulder kind of a day.
Yeah.
Did it look similar this year?
From what we heard from Brandon, our State House reporter, and our videographer, Alan Umbathi, it was still kind of packed. Legislators were spaced out in the House chambers. I know there's talk of moving full House sessions to the Governance Center so that they can spread out a little bit farther. But it was still there were limitations on media for like the number of cameras or the number of, you know, people that needed malt box access who could actually be on the floor of the chambers.
Sure.
Or in, you know, everything like that. But it was still crowded in an uncomfortable way during a global pandemic.
Well, we have an education chief, or what are they calling it? The state education secretary?
I believe so. Yeah. Education secretary. Governor Holcomb announced Katie Jenner as Indiana's first ever appointed education secretary. Holcomb announced his pick for the state's top school official in a statement on Thursday. Jenner currently actually serves as the governor's senior education advisor, a position she's held throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. She also serves as a member of the governor's Teacher Compensation Commission. The group is expected to make recommendations for lawmakers and the governor to consider as they address teacher pay during the 2021 legislative session. What's really important about Jenner is that leading up to the gubernatorial race, all of the gubernatorial candidates had announced that, you know, they were really looking for someone with an education background. And Jenner absolutely fills exactly the criteria that Holcomb had laid out. And so there are a number of folks across the state that were applauding her selection yesterday.
And we have another cabinet filling, and this is a new position. Of course, this is the Equity and Inclusion Officer. Who do we know is going to be taking that seat?
Yeah, her name is Kara Herring. She was selected to fill the newly created position. Holcomb first proposed the creation of a diversity officer for his cabinet in August in response to the summer's protests over racial inequality and police brutality. She currently is the director of public affairs at the University of Notre Dame and will officially join state government in her new role on February 1st.
Okay, that was a long-anticipated appointment, and good to know that they've got someone good in that position. And what has all of this talk been about turning Indianapolis into a basketball bubble this coming March? What's happening?
Isn't Indianapolis already a basketball bubble? My first job in journalism was a basketball magazine. Like, we've always been this.
You're absolutely right about that.
So the NCAA is considering moving all of its 67 March Madness games to Indianapolis. The organization hopes to consolidate venues to reduce risk during the pandemic. The pandemic has caused NCAA officials to rethink how to run one of its highest revenue tournaments. The organization said after monitoring other sports and their championships, consolidating the 13 previously selected locations would reduce risk. But it is very, very important to note, nothing is official. This is, if I were to wager an educated guess, this is the NCAA kind of testing the waters to see, like, hey, what do we think about this?
Well, I mean, truly, though, Lauren, don't you think Indianapolis would be just the best place to do this.
I mean, I'm a little bit biased because
I think we might be biased, but
I mean, the other thing is that we do have a number of locations, right? I don't remember who it was on Twitter, and I feel bad that I don't, because I'm sure it was a local reporter. But somebody was talking about the idea of just having NCAA tournaments in some of these giant high school basketball, you know, arenas, and how cool that would be to kind of showcase that for a national television audience for the NCAA.
Get them out in Newcastle. Goodness.
I just keep them on the west side. Go to Ben Davis.
Well, you could do that, too, yeah. I suppose. Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's great. All right. Well, fingers crossed for that. Well, Lauren, I wanted to leave a couple minutes here at the end to announce something. You and the team at Indiana Public Broadcasting know this already, but we haven't told the audience yet. I'm actually leaving the show. I got a great opportunity here in town that I thought long and hard about and ultimately decided to take. Next Wednesday is my last day, but you'll be hearing me intermittently in repeats throughout the month. The month of December, and then a little bit in January while we search for a permanent replacement. I want to emphasize, though, that my heart is really heavy over this. Doing the show has been a dream come true for me. I'd always wanted to host a talk show, and to be able to do it on public radio and have it go out to a statewide audience is the sweetest icing on the greatest cake you could imagine. A big thanks to Matt Schaefer Powell for that. I'll always be proud of what we did here and what we do here, and I'll be the biggest cheerleader for whoever sits in this seat next. As it turns out, we'll be having a few guest hosts come in. WFYM Morning News anchor Taylor Bennett. She'll be doing a few shows. She's fabulous. Our education reporter, Jeannie Lindsay, will fill in. I'm not for picking favorites, Lauren, but you and Jeannie are two of the coolest people on the IPBS team. So I'm happy she'll be hosting. Jill Sheridan is a WFYI city reporter. She's filled in for us before. She's taken the month of January. And, of course, our producers, Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason, will continue to do the great work that you're used to on this show. It'll just be a different voice behind all of it. And let me say something about those two. Micah stepped in when Maggie left, and we love Maggie Galon so much. It was hard to imagine doing the show without her. But Micah is a young, hungry journalist. She's been doing really impressive work since she came on. And Drew is the boss around here, and I wouldn't have it any other way. He's got high standards. What are you laughing at? Drew knows what he's doing more than most people I've ever worked with doing anything. So the show remains in very, very capable hands. And that goes for Adam, our technical director, too. There's nobody I'd rather geek out with than Adam Gross. I want to thank the All In audience for listening. Keep doing it. Support the station you hear us on right now. That support will keep the show sounding great. Lauren, I would drop this mic right now, but it's expensive, and I have 40 minutes of radio left to do. So that ain't happening. But I want to thank you, too, for doing these Friday segments with me as well. You're the greatest.
No, actually, you are. You're the person who made me comfortable being on live radio. And it's I didn't come into radio naturally. This is not my first love of journalism. But this, you know, you've opened the door, kicked it open for me. And for that, I'll always be grateful.
Lauren, you're awesome. All right. Onward and upward. Next, we'll look at Indiana's Next Level Jobs program and why it's being hailed as innovative and highly effective. What's so different about it, though, and who's it helping? We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The pandemic has put a lot of stress on Indiana's job market, so the state is heavily promoting a government-run jobs program that's been around for a few years now. Our workforce development reporter, Justin Hicks, been keeping an eye on it. Hi, Justin.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. So which program are we talking about here?
So we're talking about the Next Level Jobs program. The Next Level Jobs program could be thought of as existing in sort of two different tracks. One is a track for employees, people like us, you know, who just go to work every day. And the other is for employers, so companies who want to think about training employees. So that one track for the employees, which, you know, most of us fall in, there is a thing called the Workforce Ready Grant. And that Workforce Ready Grant will pay for you essentially to go to Ivy Tech or Vincennes. Recently, Indiana Tech, I think, was added to that list of eligible providers. But you could basically go to a community college and take some classes, and the state will pay for it because those classes will hopefully lead to a certification in a career and help you get a job. On the other side of that, with the employer training grant, if you're on that track and if you're a company and you're thinking about how do I train up or skill up my existing workers to fill some jobs that I need to have filled, they can get, you know, quite a sizable amount of money, you know, $50,000, currently $100,000, actually, you know, to state funds to retrain workers. So it's kind of a two-tiered approach, but it's all under the auspices of Next Level Jobs.
So how long has this program, Next Level Jobs, been around?
Yeah, so this was started around 2017. It was kind of part of the whole, you know, next level package of things that were sort of rolled out by Governor Eric Holcomb. And so this was sort of a jobs plan that was rolled out. And you have to remember, too, that this, you know, Next Level Jobs was rolled out when back in 2017, the economy was in a place where companies were looking around and saying, we want to grow, but we just don't have enough workers. And we don't have the right kinds of workers. And to some extent, we're kind of still there. The pandemic obviously has changed that dynamic a lot and the economy a lot. But that's when it was created, 2017, to kind of help companies find people to work for them. And if you couldn't find the right person, you could create the right person, either through skills training yourself or through going through a community college.
How many people has the program helped?
Yeah, so I've got the numbers right in front of me. So I have about more than 38,000 Hoosiers have enrolled in one of these certification programs at Ivy Tech or Vincennes or something like that. So 38 have enrolled, right? About 18,000 have actually completed those eligible certification programs. So 18,000 roughly have gone all the way through the program and completed it as intended. So that's, you know, a little under half, and that's not bad. You know, and you know, I'm sure, too, even those people who didn't necessarily complete the program probably still got credit hours and maybe some things along the way that'll help them in their jobs anyways. So not necessarily a number to say it's a bad thing, but it's what it is.
Has the pandemic boosted those numbers in any way?
So it's hard to say. But so far, we do have indications, because it's kind of early, you know, when you talk about enrollments and that kind of thing. We only have the summer semester, really, and this current semester, the fall semester, to really judge that by. But I will say it looks like 9,000, like literally 9,001 people have enrolled in some kind of workforce-ready grant-eligible program at Ivy Tech this fall. So that's, I mean, that's a much bigger than the falls before. So it seems like we're on track right now to see a big boost because of the pandemic. But, you know, time will tell, and we'll see what effect it has over time.
But does it seem like the program is working? I mean, is it having the kind of effect that the state wants?
Yeah. So I think the thing to look at here is kind of how many people are using this program, how many people are seeing the value in this, and who want to actually use it. Because, you know, many times governments will come up with programs and they'll say, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we had this? And there's a lot of people who say, like, actually, we didn't need that. You know, we needed the other thing. So I went back and looked at data kind of starting in 2014, a couple years before Workforce Ready Grants were around. And you see actually a huge spike in the number of people who enrolled in classes right after the Workforce Ready Grants were announced and the Next Level Jobs program was announced. So, you know, that seems to indicate that this was something that people wanted. It really helps defray the costs for people who want to go back to school, who want to get a certification. So it does seem that people are taking advantage of this.
And so how are they promoting it? What kinds of strategies are they using right now to make sure the word gets out?
Yeah. So especially in the pandemic, one of the big strategies they did was really focus marketing and target people who are on unemployment right now who could use this the most. So that was one big way that they've been targeting folks to hear about this. They've also had a big marketing campaign with just like internet ads. You know, if you type in Next Level Jobs, I promise you your Google search results, if you're anything like mine, are just going to be plastered from now on with Next Level Jobs ads. So they have a big internet marketing campaign. I think there might be some TV ads people have told me they've seen. So, I mean, kind of all the traditional methods. But of course, the big one that they're trying out now, and this was sort of the crux of the story, was that there's a lot of people who don't necessarily watch cable TV anymore. I don't. So they're trying to go out at places right now, like food pantries, churches, things like that, trying to access those people who need the help and just haven't heard about this yet.
You focused on one particular place at the top of your story. Where'd you go?
Yeah, so it was New Corinthian Baptist Church. It's just like a little bit northwest of Indianapolis. I think it still is technically Indianapolis. But yeah, so it was out there. It's a traditionally black church. They were doing a food handout on a Saturday morning. So some people from the Indiana Office of Career Connections and Talent went out there. People from Ivy Tech went out there, set up a booth, and it was kind of an experiment. They wanted to see if they could reach these people and if it was useful. And they got a couple bites. It probably wasn't, you know, it wasn't gangbusters, I would say. But it was kind of an experiment to see what's the best way to do this. And at the very least, they put a lot of flyers and things in people's cars as they got food. So, you know, somebody might look at that a little bit later on and think, you know what? Like, don't know what this is about, but let me Google it. Let me find out more.
Is there an eligibility question for this? Like, who's eligible? Is anyone eligible?
Yeah. So it's targeted more when it comes to the Workforce Ready Grant. And that's the grant, again, that helps you go back to Ivy Tech, per se. That is targeted towards people with sort of education that acts like an associate's degree or lower. So people who need some kind of post-secondary education in order to get a job. And that could be really, really specialized. It could be like, I want to get like a CDL license or something, per se. And it also has to be within one of these like five areas that are high growth right now. So if you're in advanced manufacturing, building construction, health, life sciences, IT, or transportation, if you want to get a job in any one of those fields, it'll cover your training. And also if you have less than an associate's degree. If you have more than that, or if you don't really want to get a job in one of those fields, may not be the most useful thing for you.
You talked to a group that gave you some insight into why these programs are good right now. What'd they say?
Yeah, so the National Skills Coalition, they were telling me that it's actually pretty rare. This Next Level Jobs program, not a lot of states have a thing like this. And in fact, a lot of states are actually just now starting programs like this as a result of the pandemic. It's been seen around the country as kind of a really good way to try to kind of nudge people back to work, but not with like a stick, but with a carrot, right? To say, we can offer you ways to get even better jobs if you want to get this education. So the National Skills Coalition said like that is what they're all about. They love that idea, and they saw Indiana's program as being really proactive because, like we said, this has been around since 2017. It wasn't created as the result of the pandemic, but it just so happened to be around, and so we can amp it up during the pandemic as a really good response.
You spoke to somebody who was a pretty good example of the type of person that this is kind of designed to help, someone who had a traditional job but doesn't necessarily have the skills to work in, I guess, a modern job. Who was she?
Yeah, so Tella Ruth, she was actually a parishioner at the church, and she had actually shown up, I think, more to volunteer than anything with the food handout. And so she kind of walked by the booth and saw this thing going on and thought she would stop and talk. And she wound up staying, I think, maybe a little bit longer than she bargained for, talking with these folks from Ivy Tech. And she came away from it learning, hey, you know what? Like, I need, she said she knew that she needed for a long time kind of a little refresher course on Microsoft Word, Microsoft Office, you know, basic computer skills. And she currently doesn't have a job. And so she knew that if she was going to get back on the job train there, that she would kind of need a little bit of help. So when she found out about that, she said, you know what? That's really cool. Never knew about that before. And now that I know about it, I'm going to take one of these classes. So I'll be honest with you. I haven't followed up with her to see if she actually did enroll. But she said she would. So we'll see.
Justin Hicks is Indiana Public Broadcasting's workforce development reporter. Justin, thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Matt.
Of course, COVID is still the reason for so many other disruptions as well. And for those who rely on recovery meetings to fight addiction, the colder months and rising cases could keep in-person meetings from happening and increase the chances for relapse. Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson reported on this earlier this week. She joins us now. Hi, Darian.
Hi, Matt.
It's never a good time for a pandemic, but one of the people that you talked to described the timing when it came on in the spring as lucky. Why is that?
You know, I spoke with Brandon George from the Indiana Addictions Issues Coalition, and he said a silver lining of the pandemic starting in the spring was that 12-step programs like, you know, AA or NA and other recovery resources could hold meetings outside, you know, social distancing at places like parks or parking lots. Usually those meetings are in places like church basements or community centers. And obviously with the stay-at-home orders, those are starting to shut down. Unfortunately, we are starting to see some restrictions on group gatherings again. And this time around, with the winter weather, meetings outside won't really be ideal.
I thought another thing he said was interesting, this idea that the solution for the pandemic was the opposite solution for the other epidemic that we've been fighting for a lot longer. Why is that?
Yeah, he actually called the opioid epidemic and the COVID pandemic a twindemic. He said that there is a saying in the recovery community that the opposite of addiction isn't recovery, it's connection. That connection could be with mentors, sponsors, friends and family, even coworkers. The pandemic and the stay-at-home orders that came with it really made that connection hard. And so social isolation can be deadly, especially for those with depression or substance use disorder.
Have we seen more overdoses during the pandemic?
Unfortunately, overdose rates are increasing nationwide. In Indiana, there were overdoses where overdoses started to go down in 2019. Emergency departments are now seeing more than 80% rise this year. There also have been an increase in overdose deaths in Indiana, more than 30% increase between January and May.
So many of us, though, are getting by with virtual meetings. Why not just meet online?
Yeah, so when the stay-at-home orders went into effect, a lot of meetings went virtual. Unfortunately, technology access isn't universal or equal among everyone. You know, people might not have access to a smartphone or a computer, or they might not have internet access. A lot of people rely on public libraries for computers. And, you know, when those closed, they couldn't access a computer. And also, some people might not be comfortable using a computer or doing a video call.
Do we know if meeting virtually, though, is as effective as meeting in person?
You know, it really depends on the person. For some people, they might feel more comfortable being behind a computer compared to sitting in a big group setting. But for others, they might need that in-person connection.
I talked to you a few weeks ago about mental health symptoms like anxiety and depression, those being exacerbated by the pandemic. And addiction can be a separate issue, but how often are they seen together?
They're often seen together, and they can even overlap. Depression and anxiety can make substance use disorder worse and vice versa. I spoke with a researcher at the Regenstief Institute in Indianapolis, Dr. Kurt Kronke, and he said, unfortunately, a person with substance use disorder may not be able to treat their anxiety, or a person with anxiety may only be able to focus on getting into recovery. He says it's very important to treat both at the same time because they are oftentimes so interconnected.
You talked to one person who went into recovery in the middle of the pandemic. How has it gone for him?
You know, he says it's been really tough at times, especially because when his depression and anxiety gets really tough, he sometimes still gets those urges to use. However, he did say that luckily with social distancing, it's been a bit easier to stay away from the people and things who might be an influence on relapsing.
So in this case, social distancing and some of the things that are protecting us from COVID are actually protecting him from his addiction, because there is a social element sometimes to addiction as well, I guess.
Yeah. However, in that same vein, he said if non-essential businesses start closing down again, that's going to be really tough because he does, you know, keep busy by going to work every day. So that could also lead to more depression and anxiety, which in turn could lead to a potential relapse.
A lot of eyes are on the 2021 legislative session. Is there any hope that they'll be able to commit any legislation or resources to the opioid crisis next year?
There is definitely hope. The 2021 legislative session is a big budget year also. You know, there's been an opioid crisis in the state for a very long time, and advocates are looking for funding and resources to help combat that, and, you know, more permanent funding for the relaxed telehealth laws that went into effect during the pandemic. The 2020 session, there was a bill that extended the state's safe syringe exchange program, and advocates are really hoping for a more permanent extension for that. Unfortunately, they fear that, obviously with COVID, that more relief goes there. So they're hoping that they don't get, you know, tabled for the next year, because neither pandemic is going to go away anytime soon.
Did the Indiana General Assembly do anything this past session with regard to addiction?
In 2020, they allowed the Safe Syringe program to go for another year instead of increasing for a bit longer. So that, you know, gave some of the state programs a little bit longer. But other than that, not really.
Is there concern that money at the state level that would otherwise go to addiction treatment or mitigation will instead be committed to COVID?
Yeah, you know, there's fear that funding that would otherwise go to substance use disorder resources will go to COVID relief. However, addiction advocates are working very closely with legislators, and they have been since the last legislative session ended. So they still have some hope that there will be some money and funding to go towards resources that they need.
Darian Benson is a reporter for Side Effects Public Media, which is a public health news collaborative based out of our flagship station, WFYI, in Indianapolis. Darian, thanks.
Thanks, Matt.
Up next, it's been a rough year, so you might feel an urge to make the holidays particularly special by splurging on gifts for your loved ones or even yourself. But Pete the Planner says, hold on. We'll get some tips on how to keep our finances in check next. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. 1 week from today is Black Friday, then Cyber Monday, then Giving Tuesday. By then, many of us won't have much left in the budget for charities and nonprofits. Considering the year it's been, the holidays probably won't look the same for a host of reasons. And if you're wondering how to prioritize your spending while also leaving a little leftover for gifts and giving, we have Pete the Planner with us to help out. Hi, Pete.
Matt, it is always good to be with you.
It's great to have you. So we're well into the ninth month of this pandemic and the economic fallout that it's created. What are some of the most common financial issues you're seeing right now among families who are trying to figure out a way through this?
You know, what's really strange is I'm seeing parallels between, you know, what people are calling pandemic fatigue in terms of people honoring social distancing and masking, right? We're just sort of tired of it. So people stop, which I wish they wouldn't. Matt, I'm seeing that on the financial front too. I think people are just so sick of this that they're spending like they used to, which, as you might imagine, is actually problematic, right? Because I don't think this thing is over. I don't think the economy is done dipping. And I think the next couple months are going to be pretty hairy, and people are going to justify their spending right now this holiday season by saying, I just want to feel normal for 30 days. I'll worry about this later. I think that's what's going to happen.
But what about the people who really do feel like they're in an okay position? I mean, should they be thinking twice as well?
Yes, but it's based on the subjectivity of what it is to be in an okay position. What's really funny, so I've been doing this for 20 years. It is honestly not until the last 10 months or so, Matt, that I've tried to actually quantify financial stability. I mean, for most people, it's, oh, we have an emergency fund. Okay. We've determined there are 10 factors of financial stability, and your emergency fund is certainly one of those factors. But I think most people are just misreading the room being their financial life. So there's this overconfidence, which, look, I'm not trying to be a dunny downer here, but I think people have rose-tinted glasses as it relates to their financial situation, even in the midst of a recession and a pandemic.
I appreciated last week's column in the IBJ about the husband who bought a boat on a whim without telling his wife. You compared that kind of spending to stress eating, which I thought was a brilliant comparison. Could you kind of stretch that out for us a little bit? Why might the stress of this year cause us to do something like that?
We just want to feel good. We just want to feel the dopamine hit of eating something you shouldn't eat, spending money because it makes you feel like you have money. Matt, that's the crazy thing about this. The glory of spending money is not only the acquisition of whatever it is you're buying, even if it's an experience, but it's the act of feeling like in that moment you had the money to spend. And that is the great sort of financial fallacy of the American lifestyle, is that we've gotten to a point since the 1950s with the use of consumer debt where you're able to feel good by spending money, even though you borrowed the money you spent. And so, you know, this, the column, I my head's been spinning since I got the email from the lady. A lady emailed me and said that her and her husband haven't been getting along. And then she said she hopes her husband sees this column. So I just ended up writing the answer to him, assuming that he read it. And I get it. The guy was hurting. He lost some income. And, you know, have you not been there? Have we not all been, in a behavioral sense, just reaching and trying to feel better in any means necessary? And he was doing it via spending. I do it via eating. But everyone's got their own vice, right?
Indeed. But how have you helped couples talk to each other about that? She wrote an email to you for your help, and it sounds like they're not talking, which is really kind of what should be happening. How do you, and it's hard to do, right? You got to be gingerly about it. How do you kind of work them together when you see a sort of situation like that amongst a couple who may become coming directly to you for help?
I think financial challenges amongst married people are often a symptom, not necessarily the affliction itself, right? So getting people to respectfully understand that from the outset. And if I'm being 100% transparent, something I've really been working on the last 10 months and something I've been working on the last couple months, more specifically as it relates to politics, is really challenging personally why I think what I think and opening myself up to the idea that just because I think it's that way doesn't mean it's right. And I think getting couples to understand, you know, hey, my dad raised me this way. This is the way we've always done it. Okay, great. I like the discipline. I like the leadership your parents showed. But however, let's explore the idea here that A, it may not be right. And B, and more importantly, it may not be right for your marriage. And I think that's a lot of self-reflection. And I'll be honest, I'm not so sure people have the energy to try to do that right now.
Do you see the same kinds of things happening as was illustrated by the email about the boat? Do you see the same kinds of things happening as we head into the holidays? I guess you do. You've kind of already mentioned it. But I mean, this headspace that people have been put in, the fact that this has been the year that it's been, and we might feel the urge to overcompensate and make the holidays really special by spending money and giving gifts, even though things might be tighter this year. What are those common mistakes that people could make in the next few weeks that could really make 2021 just as difficult?
I think sometimes with great adversity, you have the opportunity to hit the reset button on habits that you've otherwise accepted as, well, this is the way we do it. You know, a conversation I've had a lot recently with just various readers and whatever is this idea of, hey, my family, my extended family consistently overspends on each other during the holidays. We've always been uncomfortable with it. And my brother and sister-in-law lost their job. How can we, reimagine this gift-giving process? And I think it's fascinating. If you can't press reset on some of the traditions that never actually really made sense financially during this period of time, when will you ever press reset on that nonsensical spending? So I'll also say, Matt, that people also have an opportunity to, you know, support their local community, even their local food community. Assuming my mom and dad don't listen to this particular interview here today, no offense, Matt. you know, my wife and I are planning on buying them a holiday meal from a local restaurant that's putting together holiday meals as a means to survive. And that just makes a lot more sense to us than me buying my mom another wreath or a candle or my dad another greatest dad tie.
Okay, so I'm not asking you to be a geneticist or a psychologist here, but is this sort of overspending or compensation spending, not just around the holidays, but anytime, is that learned behavior or could that be hereditary? What have you seen, I guess, in the patterns of the people who you've helped over the years?
Oh, boy. Boy, I mean, everyone who went to school with me, both at the high school and college level, is just laughing the idea that I would have to try to answer this, given the, of my academic prowess. But I would say this. In my column, I talked about how I come from a family of stress eaters. And I think how one copes with stress, how one copes with resources, feels learned to me in that moment, right? It's like, well, I saw you do it. I'm going to do it. I can't imagine it's as hereditary as something like actual physical health. I don't know.
I guess the point I'm trying to make is that some people might think they're just wired that way and they might then choose to give up on trying to fix it, I suppose. Have you seen that happen? Have you seen that sort of willful allowance for the status quo to just remain?
Now you're pushing my secret buttons that get me all upset. So you've climbed into my head this holiday season, my friend. Okay, so here's the thing. Saying, well, I'm not good with money or I struggle with math. That's not a thing. Like that's not an excuse to bow out of a responsible moment. And so I do see that a lot. I do see people, I'm not good with money, so my significant other does it. Meanwhile, your significant other isn't good with money either, but they're stepping up and doing it. I think something that solves a lot of these challenges, and I think maybe we've talked about this before, maybe not, who knows, is this concept of setting household financial standards. They're just the rules of your household. It's the, well, this is the way we do it. And I'll give you just a couple quick examples and tell you how you make it work. But let's say, oh, we always max out our 401k. We always have 3 months expenses. We never have credit card debt. Now, Matt, when you hear that, you're thinking, well, of course, yeah, that would be nice. So those are lovely standards if you can do them. I will offer you this, though. It needs to become your standard before it's your reality. And I think setting rules of your financial household get people on the same page and they make decisions easier because you're not constantly deciding from a behavior standpoint whether I'm doing this or that. You're just honoring your standard. And I think for people who share finances together, more rules make it better because they're all on the same page. So this is currently my favorite topic, the idea of financial standards in a household that, you know, if you grew up and your household did not have financial standards, then you're forced to create your own. Or if you grew up and your household did have financial standards, if it's a good one, then you can make it part of your own household. And I think that's super important.
Let's bring it back to the holidays and the sales, which are going to crop up soon. They're going to be enticing to people. Retailers haven't had the year they'd hoped for. I'm sure they're going to try to make up for it by offering deep discounts on things. And some people have a really hard time resisting that, even if they technically can't afford it. What kind of advice do you have for fighting that urge to take advantage of a sale, even if we have to put it on credit?
All right. So throughout our entire careers, we make a finite amount of income. You just don't know what it is, right, Matt? I mean, you think you know what it is, but our careers evolve. I would look at the next 60 days and look at the money that is projected to come in and look at the finite amount of money that is available to you and help that guide what's going on. Too often, because we have a credit line, too often because traditionally we spend money this time of year, we put all these sorts of excuses out there as to, well, I don't actually have to mind the P's and Q's of my financial life. I would tell you, I think the economy gets much worse in January than it is right now. And if you take the time to look 60 days ahead and work backwards from that number, I think that can dissuade you from your traditional spending. At least that's the way I see it right now.
I'm going to put a scenario in front of you. Traditional family, husband, wife, two kids, mortgage. One parent's been able to keep working. The other hasn't worked since the spring. It's a common tale. They're getting by, but things are as tight as a drum. They celebrate Christmas, and they just want things to feel normal this year. What should they then be cautious about?
Well, I think two intelligent adults would say, let's make it normal for the kids. and let's be more sensible about how we spend for each other. Right. At some level, I feel like at this point I'm giving like romance tips, like financial romance tips. So it's like everyone's really turned off by this. But I will say that it's not that unusual for people to want their kids to feel like nothing's gone on. Kids have had a terrible 2020. Like the fact that my son can see his friend from 20 feet away with a mask on, but they can't do their normal wrestling and whatever 8-year-old boys do, that makes me really sad. And I'm sad for him. And so look, there's nothing wrong if parents want to make the holiday the same it's always been, but at some level you got to pull back on the gifts you get each other or you get your extended family. I wish spending made this all go away. I really do. And honestly, it does make the feeling go away for a little bit till the credit card bill comes 30 days later. And then you're in the midst of January dealing with some pretty nasty stuff. I mean, not to get too deep into it, but if that eviction moratorium doesn't get extended, it's going to get ugly early in January.
How can parents turn this kind of a situation if they know that they maybe can't give their kids the holiday season that they hope to give them? How can they then turn it into a teaching experience for the kids? Is there a way they can soften that a little bit?
I think so. I mean, even within my business, we're not giving the normal holiday gifts we give to our clients. We're making a big donation to a food bank, right? And it's that just makes more sense. Like, no offense, I love chocolates and pretzels and chocolate covered pretzels more than anybody, as I've already admitted to. But on some level, we just have to look at what's happening in our community. And what an opportunity to look at your kids and say, hey, we're going to have some fun this year for the holiday season, but you know, a lot of people aren't eating right now. So let's as a family choose how, you know, what we're going to do here. I mean, that's a little idealistic. I feel like I'm an extra on Leave It to Beaver right now. However, there were no food banks though on television back in the day, but it's a real problem that a lot of people are dealing with right now. And I think it takes real people like your listeners to take action to fix it.
One thing that always surprises me is the level of financial trouble that really well-to-do families can get themselves into. What are some common mistakes that a family like that might make during the holidays?
A high income doesn't make you stable. And it's funny, I'm going to say that again because I want people to really absorb that. A high income does not make you financially stable. And that is counterintuitive. Because what you assume is that, well, that high income gives you a lot of opportunity. No, no, no. It gives you a lot of opportunity to set your lifestyle like everyone else. And if you set it too high, you're just as unstable as someone who has a low income. So what we're seeing with this particular recession is that, yes, a lot of people on the lower side of the income scale are affected. And that's terrible. I mean, that's always the case, right? But you're seeing a lot more people on the upper end of the income scale, based on what industry they're in, that are getting really messed up. And I would say the universal lack of empathy for those folks doesn't exactly help. You say, oh, well, it must be nice to make what you made. And it's like, well, yeah, but it's just math at this point. And I'm not making what I used to make. And my lifestyle was built on that. I mean, I could talk for 7 hours about empathy and the lack of it in the financial world. But I think it gets down to, you know, you get on social media and you see financial wizards give everyone the tips that they need to get by financially. And there are always things that are just real ignorant of the fact that people have behavior issues, right? That, hey, save this, do this, don't do that. I mean, I've given those tips for 2 decades too, but what I've come to learn recently is this really is about financial overeating and not as simple as do this, do that. It's just more complex than that.
In our last 30 seconds, do you have like a mantra for your budgeting philosophy that you could leave us with?
I have the lazy man's budget. I take care of business first, TCB, take care of business first, which means fund my goals the way they need to be funded. And then what I spend after that doesn't matter. I never feel bad about it because I hit the goals first and we refuse to go into credit card debt. So be lazy, hit your goals first, and then spend whatever you want on whatever you want.
Peter Dunn, better known as Pete the Planner, is a financial consultant based in Carmel, Indiana. Pete, thanks.
Always fun, my friend.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer, and he composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana for topic alerts and discussion. I'm Matt Pelser. Have a great weekend. This is All In.